and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. The podcast is also available on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn. And this has been a 2-month unexpected hiatus, but it is just in time for the 3-year anniversary. And I'm really happy that the podcast has gone on for 3 years and more than 60 episodes at this point. So I want to thank everyone for listening and who's been on. I cannot thank you enough. So extended gratitude for 3 years of work and listening and good vibes. Today's episode is with Jenny Zhang. She is the author of the latest story collection, Sour Heart, as well as Dear Jenny, We Are All Fined, and also The Selected. And she's published all over the place. I'm a huge fan of her nonfiction, and I'm really excited to talk to her about her collection and her process. And I really want to thank her and her publicist, Dara, for setting up this interview. This interview that Jenny and I had was conducted via phone, so you'll hear some audio modulation, which I've edited as best as I could, and it's all good stuff, so thanks again for listening. So congratulations so much on Sour Heart.
Thank you. I'm really excited.
How are you feeling about it?
I had a lot of jitters before, just because
I'm comfortable with living a little bit of my life online and publicly, but I really want to protect my inner flame and my private life and stuff. So I was definitely kind of worried that it would be like some kind of deep loss of privacy, but I'm actually realizing that there's a bit of control I can exert over that. And I was like worried, I don't know, it's just always a little bit, I'm always like fearful that people will read my fiction as memoir, and I just got really afraid of that happening. But that actually hasn't happened much, and now the book launch date has come and gone, and I feel good. I feel like, I don't know, I'm always like nervous about birthday parties, but then I'm like happy right after this is over.
And it's so interesting you mentioned the kind of fiction being seen as memoir, because you have written essays. You've written very personal, very explicit stories that I definitely connected with as a woman of color, but also as a Native New Yorker in a lot of ways, and things that I didn't notice as an African American, I wonder if my contemporaries and people in my cohort as Asian Americans also witness that I was also attributed to, you know, like contributed to, I should say. So I was like, oh, shit. When you're writing about, I don't know if I'm saying it right, the Cheongsam, and you wrote about the white girls wearing those, and also empathy, and all these things. I was like, oh, shit. I did what's now kind of legit for us in the press world is stalked you online. and you make it very accessible because you have all the links to all your work on your website.
Yeah. It's not totally updated, but yeah, I try to.
I'm going to just emphasize to people, go to Jenny Zhang's website, look at all her stuff. It's freaking amazing because I read your BuzzFeed piece. And that's how I was introduced to you, was through the BuzzFeed piece. So I'm being introduced to you through nonfiction, finding out you do poetry, and then you have your book coming out. So going down that rabbit hole and seeing what kind of, just like your voice. And it was so interesting to see how different your fiction is, but I also see that alignment too.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, and one of my favorite stories from Sour Heart is Our Mothers Before Them. And I'm a person who really likes the before and after, this kind of looking at family over time. So having that 30-year gap and looking back and forth and trying to understand the parents now via what they went through then and not totally knowing the whole story, but those like details that you thread throughout the story. I loved all the stories, but that really stuck out to me because that's kind of my own aesthetic. So I wanted to talk about in terms of, because I could totally see that, people thinking, oh, this is how you live, right? This is your family, especially when you have stories where the main protagonist's name is Jenny.
Oh, that's so you. And they're Asian. And they're New York, obviously.
Yeah, totally.
But you're saying that hasn't happened, but I can see that when it comes to your nonfiction, there seems to have been people who really do want to infiltrate your space and kind of give their opinion unwanted and unrequested.
Yeah, well, I think, like, you know, I'm often, I hope at least, offering ideas that are not necessarily, going to be, like, great compressed political mottos mm-hmm. that are pure and virtuous. Like, I'm not interested always in doing that. I'm trying to, like, you know, raise questions that lead to more questions. I'm trying to flip the stone over and examine it from every single side. And I do think that sometimes in that way of, like, you know, women of color have the burden of representation and I think it can be disturbing when someone shirks that or refuses to accept that as the only framework under which they can write. And so, like, one of the things that it's okay to explore something that doesn't necessarily fit perfectly into some political ideology, but that is still in service of, I don't know, like being after some kind of nuanced truth or something. I'm talking so abstractly right now,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
to bring it in a little bit more, it's just a lot of my nonfiction has been about, you know, like looking inward and not just confessing times in which I've been bad, but using myself and my life story as a vessel for exploring certain ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of love is possible when we're all still struggling to break out of our colonized ideas of what beauty and love and affection and care are? Is there a kind of caring that can also contain a power, like power dynamics and dominance? Is it really just that some people are great and some people are evil, or is it more complicated mm-hmm. than that? I'm interested in that stuff, and I do think that sometimes in raising that up, there's this, I don't know, like if it makes someone uncomfortable, that's okay, but I think, and I think I've said this before, like ideally when you're made uncomfortable, you know, you're willing to explore why instead of just mm-hmm. being, I'm uncomfortable because this horrible thing was forced upon me and the person who forced me, terrible. Mm-hmm. And I think there's often like a search for confirmation. I need to prove that this person is, can be dismissed, is problematic, has no value to offer. I don't know, like recently someone, I don't know, showed me this Tumblr that was your fave is problematic. And it was just like every single
person.
That one. Yeah, it's just, I was like, wow, this is like population of every single person who has more than like, who, like more than 20,000 people know about. And I'm not saying that's stupid or there's no use in that, but also I don't know, like to me that's just one more piece of information that I'm glad to have as I every single day navigate and try to live as ethically and well as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, it's not that like I'm opposed to being read autobiographically, it's just more like autobiography can really be recognized as the author, and mm-hmm. I just didn't want that to happen, and with relation to Sour Heart, I don't want my autobiography to be invoked as like a way of, I don't know, making some kind of grand comment about Asian Americans in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want that to be the case, or I don't want what people think my relationship with my parents, I don't want them to guess on that relationship and then use it kind of be like, oh God, you know, aren't these people terrible? Who does this?
Yeah.
I just, that was what I was afraid of. That was a very long way of saying a very simple thing. I don't know, but like, I'm not opposed to just talking about autobiography and how that functions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also really interesting how people of color use and play with autobiography and tease it and skirt it. I think that's, I don't know, maybe not talked about because sometimes we just stop the sentence at did this really happen to you? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because I wonder about this from my own work, is I was talking to some other artist about it and saying, I'm so aware of what I don't want to portray in my work. Mm. And their response was, well, that can be inhibiting your work because you're so worried about presenting the drug-dealing black person or, you know, like the single mother, the welfare recipient, because we see it so much so that that may not be your story, but it's inhibiting your process by being so aware of it at the same time.
Right, right. That's really interesting. Yeah, and then what do you do if the story you want to tell happens to be very useful, racist and white supremacy or something, and, but that just happens to be the story you want to tell, like, what are you supposed to do? You're kind of a little bit stuck in this pretty intense quandary.
Yeah, but there's also kind of this, because you did your research and you were also had your questions and going through with your process, it sounds like you also went through a sort of diligence of, I'm just going to use it, like the freedom of the creative process, but also an awareness of those institutional systems at the same time,
right,
which can happen, that balance.
Right. Yeah, I was constantly, I mean, I think, in doing some interviews about this book and having to think about how did I actually write it, you know, I was like, I think in the beginning, I tried to write like everyone was dead, you know. I tried to write as if, like, there was no one left on earth and I could say anything. But then after that, after a few drafts, especially if I'm trying to get this work published, and I was, and I wanted it to be published and read widely, then I just, I have to start accepting who is alive and amongst those who are alive, like, who has power to talk about this book, who has power to distribute it, who has power to put it down and see, like, how I, as the author, would be positioned and how these stories would be positioned. If there are 1,000 books that, you know, anyone can name off the top of their head about the Asian American experience, then I feel a lot less pressure because I'm, okay, no one's going to read just my book and come to any kind of conclusion. But because there isn't, I have to get real and this could be the only thing someone reads about this group, or this could be the only thing someone reads by me. And when I read one thing by someone I don't know, I'm not prone to be charitable. If I find something that's off, I'm not like, I bet they had the best of intentions. Let me go seek out their other work and just verify that they're, you know, meant no harm. I don't do that, so I don't expect anyone to do that for me. And I expect, especially in this internet age, even a sentence can be, you know, what someone's judgment is resting on. So I had to really be kind of careful in revising, in trying to, I don't know, literally thinking of every single possible way this work could be read. And I do think when you're a minority writer, a writer of color, a writer with more marginalized identity, you know, when you are writing from a marginalized community, just numbers-wise, you can expect, especially if you end up reaching more than those who are in your community, you can expect that you will be read with people who simply just don't have the education, knowledge, skills, intimacy to be able to read as deeply into your work as someone else. It's just, that's just how it is. And so you have to almost, I don't know, include, there's like some element of education that I think writers of color have to always consider. And either decide, like, I'm just completely going to not even fuck with that, or you're going to decide, okay, for the people who already know this and don't need me to have an explanatory paragraph about these words or these terms, they're going to roll their eyes or be bored, but I'm just going to include that explanatory paragraph and cater to the more dominant gaze, or dominant white gaze or something. And that's a thing, I don't know, that I think a lot of writers of color have to wrestle with, and I don't know, just that's something you have to always, like, think about.
Yeah. Well, I also was thinking about how specific your voice is, right? Because I was saying earlier, even though this is a different genre, having read your nonfiction, I was like, oh, I'm not surprised this is by Jenny Vang. It doesn't sound so off the mark in terms of the material there and how your online presence is, that I would think, oh, these are two separate people. Or, you know, that's just my thinking. I'm sure someone else might say, oh, I wouldn't have even predicted if I didn't see the name. But that's not how I personally felt. And there was such a truth to it. I mean, I hope I'm an attentive reader in that way. So, but I was thinking, like, when I was reading the story, you know, I just thought, and I'm using air quotes, this dark tone, you know, these ways that we see women positioned. I feel as though we are steered in a certain way to have a certain narrative perspective and to describe that in a certain way that's accessible. Whereas I feel like men get this ability to write, you know, again, quote unquote, dark stuff, have these characters that sometimes we don't even get those layers. We're just kind of taken by the prose. They're mixing the profanity with the quote unquote educational, academic, high tiered language. Right. And then when I was reading yours, there was like some reminders, parallels in terms of subject or how it was presented in character of Sam Lipsight's earlier book. I think it's called Mina's Drive. In terms of just this kind of dark parallels of, it's not going where you think it's going to go. It never does. And I said, oh, my God, for me, this is the first time I personally have read a woman writing this kind of material and it being embraced. And it is through a big five publisher, but it's through a smaller imprint within that publisher.
Yeah.
So it seemed a really good fit because I couldn't imagine another publisher knowing how to push that work. Because I was, you know, I'm reading it, and I'm just, this is a goddamn page turner. Holy crap, what's going to happen? And I'm on my phone, so I'm just like, you know, it goes faster, but you're also frustrated because you're like, oh, my gosh, this is taking too long. Where am I getting to? What is happening? So I wanted to ask about that. Sorry, that's like a diatribe on my part. But I just wanted to ask about this because of how you landed at Lenny Letter, distinctive way of what you're looking at. And it doesn't seem as though what you're writing is different from a lot of what other women are writing. But when you sit down and read Fowler Heart, it is so different from your contemporaries who are published. It stands out so much in terms of what you did.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that, and I liked that you saw a through line. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just a thing of taste, but I think some writers are really, really good at putting on a lot of different masks, and it's almost, it's a sign of having succeeded when you're like, that book was nothing like the other work. But I don't actually like that, and I actually like writers who have very identifiable obsessions that kind of run like a fishing line through everything that they've ever made, and whether, you know, that happens on the level of theme or language or plot or character or whatever. But so thanks for that. And it was a slightly unconventional road to being published, and I say slightly because I went to college and I went to an MFA program, so it's not that unconventional. But I think within that highly, highly small, privileged world of literary people who go through institutions and do everything you're supposed to do, I did have trouble after going to Iowa for grad school finding an agent, first of all. I couldn't find an agent because I wasn't writing a novel, and it wasn't
like... Were you doing nonfiction, or were you just doing poetry at the time?
I was just writing short stories, because I went to Iowa for fiction, and I was just writing short stories, and I kept trying to write a novel, but I just couldn't, and I kept wanting to write these kind of long and short stories, and that was like another problem, is like I wasn't writing short stories short enough to be published. And, you know, I think the platonic ideal of a short story that can be published is like 3,000-word short story. And traditionally, 3,000-word short story, it's usually about, it's almost allegorical. It's supposed to be kind of about one or two things, not about 8 or 9 things, right? Like a novel can be about 8 or 9 things, but that's not really the appropriate length for a short story, range for a short story. And I would be writing these short stories that seemed novelistic, but then when I tried to actually turn them into a novel, I realized that they were just meant to be short stories that were listing and sort of maximalist but still small, if that makes sense. And so I just had a really hard time. Yeah, I had a really hard time being short enough to actually publish my short fiction, but being long enough to have books that I could sell. And I think it's really interesting. I'd be curious what you think, but I think in some ways, like, fiction is still kind of a lowly form as far as prose goes, because it doesn't really have an identifiable function. There's something capitalistic about people's veneration for nonfiction, because it's like this desire to read something that's useful, that teaches you something, that gives you, imparts info. And there's something about fiction where it's like, oh, it's not giving me any useful info, so therefore it can't really be valuable unless it's quote-unquote capital letter G, great. And so it's, if you're not writing, if the people who only read 5 or 6 novels a year want to read a great American novel, they don't want to read a bunch of short stories. So,
because there is in the rub, right? Because how many times do you hear the story's dead, the story's not dead, people are buying this, no they're not.
Yeah, with the short stories, you can at least stop after one. Anyway, that's a whole other thing, but I felt like I really needed to write a novel if I wanted to get representation, and I kind of gave up on getting representation after the first, I would say, 5 years of trying.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, 5 is not an enormously long time, but because I got so serious and felt like I was doing pretty well in my MFA program, I just was pretty surprised at first that I couldn't find an agent. And it was that thing where a lot of my peers, which I wrote about in the BuzzFeed article, a lot of my white peers were like, it's going to be really easy for you to find an agent. You're exactly what's hot right now, that kind of thing. And one by one, they all find agents and publish books. And I felt like I had fallen into like a hole of just nothing. And I decided at some point I was just going to submit this work to small presses, university presses, where you get literally $1,000 and they, you know, print 5,000 copies or something. I don't really care. I just want to publish this. It doesn't really matter. I just felt what I wanted was to get it out and then I could work on the next thing. And then even that didn't work. I didn't, you know, none of these contests wanted it. And I just was kind of in this no man's land or something for a while. And I just kind of stopped writing fiction and then was writing a lot of nonfiction for Rookie. Basically, what happened was at a Rookie reading for, the first year anniversary of Rookie magazine, I was one of the contributors who read at the reading at McNally Jackson Bookstore in New York City. And Lena Dunham also was one of the readers. She just really liked this actually short story that I wrote for Rookie and kind of, I guess, just had me on her radar. And then at some point she reached out to me out of the blue and asked me if I had an editor. And I was like, I don't even have an agent. I can't even have an editor because you need an agent to do anything with an editor. And like, I'm happy to meet one. I am legally unable to do anything with one, but I'd be happy to meet yours. And that led to me meeting Andy Ward, who is one of the few good white men in publishing, who was at Random House. And at the time, the assistant editor who worked with him was this actually really incredible woman, Kayla Ward, who no longer works in publishing. She's also a woman of color. And I think I just really lucked out because we hit it off. Like, he sent my work to her, and we, had drinks. And we just totally hit it off, and I don't know. It was different from all the other meetings I had with mostly white agents and publishers and editors, where you know how you can tell if you're going to get along with someone based on the questions they ask you?
Yes.
You know? I don't know. So many times I'd meet with agents or editors, they just ask me or say things that made me think you're kind of sus. They would be like, yeah, I just really love moving tales of immigrant struggle. And I'm like, who talks like that? What genre is that even?
That's like an Amazon category.
Yeah.
Like, you want to drill down further, it's immigrant struggle.
It's no good. Yeah, so it's, I don't white guy who came into the meeting before me. I'm sure you were into, you know, and you named actual authors and stuff. So, and with Kayla, she immediately engaged with me on the level of writing that I wanted to be engaged on. And basically what happened was my BuzzFeed article, the one I wrote about literary yellowface, went viral. And a bunch of people, agents, contacted me, and all of them, do you want to write a memoir? And,
of course,
of course, that's what they turn to, and editors. No, but I, you know, I am a writer already of fiction, and I basically chose the one agent who didn't ask me if I was writing a memoir, and again, talked to me on the level of being a writer, and that's the advice I would give to any young writer of color, who's, how do I not get used or just be someone's diversity pick or to fill someone's quota, and it's just, listen to how they talk to you. You know, if they talk to you, I love how you are the epitome of immigrant struggle or whatever, then they don't see you and they don't really read you deeply. But if they're talking to you and I see that you're really into kind of minimalism that I haven't seen in American arts and letters or that I particularly like and is similar to this writer, if they talk deeply to you about your writing, it's always a good sign. And if they talk facilely to you about your identity, that's always a bad sign.
Yeah. So that was like a roundabout, right? Because you were also
Sorry, that was really long.
Oh no, I'm happy to hear it because it's such a different. I think feel like people put Iowa so high on a pedestal as though you go to Iowa, you're guaranteed. And it's refreshing to hear another perspective of this took me a while, and here's why it took me a while.
And this
is just the reality of it too.
Yeah, I think one more thing I'll say about this is there is right now in publishing, there's been, I think, I hope, enough critique about the unbearable whiteness of it, and that people are actually, whether for good or bad reasons, finally being a little bit more assertive about finding voices that are someone other than like a white Jonathan living in Brooklyn. You know how there's like Jonathan novels.
Yeah, I call him the literary Jonathan. You know, one of the literary Jonathans.
Interchangeable. Great writers, but very interchangeable. Yeah, do you think that's happening? And why the hell shouldn't you capitalize on it and get yours? But I do think also one of the ways in which literary gatekeepers get to keep the gate closed is being very selective about who they let in. And sometimes they let in writers where they don't challenge the racism or they don't challenge the misogyny. And not to say that every piece of writing has to, but, you know, you have to kind of scratch your chin or something. How come you're only interested, you're interested in black writers, but only if they write about this? You're interested in queer writers, but only if they write about this.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's definitely what I've been saying,
Yeah. If you don't write about those things, then they're not interested or and not as interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it's obviously it was incredibly useful and beneficial for me to go to Iowa, but there was some fit, and maybe that's, I don't know, what you sussed out when reading, but my theory, which maybe I'm thinking too highly of myself, is, I don't know, my characters, some of them hate themselves, and I think that's a genre of writing white people like, which is basically marginalized people hating themselves. But some of my characters are very narcissistic, and I'm kind of better than everyone. I kind of come from the best family, and I have the best culture, and I really pity other people who are me. And I think there was something about that really turned a lot of people off. So I think that's what I think, but I don't know. I might be totally, absolutely, completely wrong in every way.
Yeah. And it's so subjective, right? Because maybe, but maybe not. Because I feel as though I fit into the category you're speaking of.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Jenny and I have so many similarities.
Because I write, when you have a persona, right? So I'm not shocked when you say that when you publish, they pretend to be us while pretending we don't exist. And suddenly everyone's like, holy crap, this political writer is writing something that's perfect. election time, this is, you know, it's so applicable, blah, 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 blah. And then when you said, actually, that's not what I'm writing, it's like, oh, because I could have.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like, my persona online is very, whiteness is a problem, acknowledge your privilege. And someone says, hey, what are you working on? Oh, I'm working on a multi-generational family narrative.
Chapbook series of she called it Revolutionary Nonfiction. It's actually a nonfiction chapbook, and I don't think she's it's all up to her, but everyone should check out her chapbook series. It's called Guillotine Press, and they do really beautiful chapbooks, like essays that are kind of cool and radical. But sorry, I interrupted you. But yeah, you were saying that about poetry.
Well, it's either, so that's why I wrongly assumed that you had gone to Iowa for poetry, because I was so also aware of your poetry as well as your nonfiction. So I was wondering, did you utilize poetry as an outlet while you were solidifying more of your fiction, or, okay, I'm going to take a break from fiction and really focus on these other kinds of outlets to kind of get a better sense of the voice I want to have, or I'm going to join a literary circle, and I guess this will be the literary circle.
I guess a little bit maybe of all of those. And, you know, it's also maybe this is speaking to the thing that you were saying earlier about the persona. You know, our personas are crafted. We craft our personas, but also often we fit them according to demand, and this, we're in a media culture that really, really wants people of color to be outraged and write about that, and it can become very limiting sometimes because you're trying to, like, it's not that you just tailor yourself to what is expected, but it's just there can be only a singular demand for this, a singular type of way of writing and being, and then it always turns out that these writers have their actual secret pet project that they actually care about, so it can be quite different from what they're writing about online and stuff. And I don't know, poetry was not necessarily my secret pet project. I guess it actually was, just contradicting myself. It was just kind of, I mean, this was in the days where I was, you know, 23-year-old fiction writer in the Iowa Writers Workshop. I didn't even know. I wasn't part of the NYC media or anything. I was part of this MFA world, and which is strikingly similar to the NYC media world. But a world where you also develop your persona. And my persona, or like what I'd come to be known for at Iowa, was Jenny Zhang, loves to write about poop and loves to be really provocative and loves to shock, you know, loves to make depraved jokes and that kind of thing. And that was, you know, like everyone came to be known for something. This person, you know, all right, another short story about cowboys, you know, in Texas. And this person would be a woman who always wrote about their dead grandmother. Everyone came to be known for something, or my friend Sarah Hayward was known for writing the happy story, and which I thought was so sweet because she would write these stories where people were happier than most people are in fiction, although they're still troubled. But I felt also when you come to be known for something, that's when you want to, that's when you like can get into a creative rut or start to feel stuck. And I think I started to feel a little bit stuck, where I felt like I was having the same conversations over and over about these stories. I was having the same debate. I just was, I'm not going anywhere, I'm not getting anywhere, I'm not improving or getting better. And so I just, poetry was the part of me that was like, oh, he's learning and playing and like experiencing. And I knew so little about poetry, to be honest, because I hadn't really taken any poetry classes formally, and I'd only read it purely as a lover of poetry.
And it was a really good time being grad student. I had access to a lot of books and access to a lot of poets because of Iowa City. Mm-hmm. And so I just started writing poetry, partially for play and to get away, you know, from writing fiction, but also because I was like, I want to expand and like get better. And I think just learning more about anything will always make you a better writer in whatever form you want to write in. So yeah, I just started writing poetry, and it was honestly kind of just, I just submitted a few times to some poetry small press contests, and I happened to win one. And then I got to New York, and I did one reading for the Stain of Poetry reading series at this bar. I forget where it is. It's near like that kind of triangle of Bed-Stuy, Bushwick. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? Near the JMZ and the Broadway. Yeah, but I did a reading at a bar there. I think it's called, like, Goodbye Blue Monday series. Then I did that reading series, and someone else did that reading series, had a poetry lit mag, and they were like, my poetry lit mag. It's this really, you know, dirty little world of 500 people who all go to the same 18 reading series and all purchase each other's lit mags. So that's just kind of, you know, popped off because of all that.
You kind of have your built-in audience. It's like, this is the community.
Yeah, everyone has agreed. We'll all read 500 of us, read all 500 of us.
Exactly.
Kind of like that. Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny, for your time.
Oh,
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this conversation.
Oh, my God. It was so fun to talk to you, and I love that, once again, each time you ask me a question, I think I answered 80 other questions by accident instead, because
my I love when that happens, that. Though, because I'm like, oh, this is a conversation, this is going so well.
Great, because it's been, I got to talk about all this stuff that no one even asked me about, so I really appreciate it, Jen. You're awesome to talk to.
Thank you again, Jenny, for being on, and thank you for listening. Again, the podcast can be found on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn, as well as on Tumblr at minoritiesandpublishing.tumblr.com and Twitter at minoritiesandpub. Thanks again for listening, and I swear the next hiatus will not be 2 months long, but thanks again for sticking with me for 3 years, and look forward to many more episodes. Take care.